Good evening.
I wasn't gonna get no response for it. I was gonna have to start over.
What I'm gonna talk about is in terms of Black Asian relationships and thinking about 50 years after Bandung, I'm gonna talk about citizen, non-citizen, immigrant issues, and I'm going to frame it particularly around prisons and what we term as the prison industrial complex. One of the things that you probably, many of you have heard it before, but when we're thinking about prisons and the prison industrial complex as it currently exists, we also have to think about it in terms of slavery and the slave trade or slave praxis in America, right? Prisons replaced plantation slavery in America, right? And so because of that, if we think about slavery and know slavery really to be the central question to the foundation of the United States and its expansion primarily, and even when you look at the states that formed later out west, California, I think in 1850, whatever, slavery is still at the heart of all of those debates of the states that came into the Union up through 1865. So even when we're talking about the U.S. and the West or whatever, we're still looking at the issue of slavery, right? So if we understand slavery and the enslavement of Black folks in America as being central to the U.S., we also then have to understand that Black people in the U.S. hold a specific position in the U.S. that is unlike other non-Black people of color in the U.S. historically. So often when you hear people and the calls for going beyond Black and white and, you know, all of those sort of calls are usually targeted to Black folks, right? I get that kind of statement all the time from folks who don't want to deal specifically with the specific relationship that Blackness, slavery, and as I'm going to talk about, criminal and criminality has to Black people in the U.S., which makes our experience unlike and makes obviously coalition at that point a difficult proposition. So I'm going to define the prison industrial complex as a term we use to describe the overlapping interests in government and industry that use surveillance, policing, and imprisonment as actions to economic, social, and political problems. Through its reach and impact, the prison industrial complex, or PIC, helps maintain authority of people who get their power through racial, economic, and other structural privileges. It's a tool of the state used to control people and maintain power, and is a system used to legitimize the state by claiming that it can only create safety for the people living under it. And so if we think about the abolition of slavery and the 13th Amendment, we'll just read to you briefly. The 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery, says that neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. Congress shall have the power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. Right, so it's neither slavery nor involuntary servitude except as a punishment for crime, right, which is central to the experience of Black people 1865 to this present day in the U.S., because the nation state has done everything to ensure that except as a punishment for crime has applied to as many Black people as possible. And since the abolition of slavery, and this is where we really start to see the first prison expansion in the U.S., and we still to this day, 50% of prisoners are in the South. Most of the states who have the death penalty are in the South, where still the majority of Black people live in the South. We see the remnants of that, and even the actual plantations are on, or even actual prisons are on former slave plantations. So again, when we're talking about solidarity and coalitions where Black people are concerned, we have to then begin to question, like, one, where, from what position are black people operating when they go to make coalition? And if we understand that black folks are virtually at the bottom of every social political category in the U.S. And really globally, because we can talk about Africa in relation to the rest of, you know, the third world, as we term it, we have to think about the fact that black people more than anybody need allies, right? So it's no surprise that Paul Robeson and some folks would reach out to folks who had extended the arm to them. When we get to when we get post-slavery and into slavery through the 1960s through the 1980s, we start to experience or have continued experience of black people being framed as criminals, right, and criminality, right. So we see through the drug war in the 1980s, black folks framed as criminals, black women framed as criminals through abusing welfare, crack mothers, all sorts of things like that. And then we start to see massive prison expansion by the 1990s. Although violent crime had been going down since the 1980s, we see prison expansion and we have 2 million people in prison today. 50% are black, which has been consistent roughly since the beginning of, since the abolition of slavery, right? When we talk about other kind of global systems, because folks will say, well, Kenyon, you're not really dealing with, like, you know, what happens to non-black folks of color, South Asians, in terms of immigration and deportation, in terms of other issues, social issues, you know, that happen to other non-black folks of color. And my response to that usually is, or to sweatshop labor, things like that, is that, first of all, we're assuming that black people don't have to function under those conditions, right? That black people aren't being deported, that black people don't work under sweatshop conditions or other such labor. There was a story in the paper a couple months ago about some homeless black men in the state of Florida who were being forced to work in a factory in horrible conditions for no wages, and there's no major kind of organizing or sympathy that they get for that work in the way that we see other people's issues around labor get framed. Also in terms of militarization, right? We often think of military and the militarization in terms of war that the U.S. certainly exports across the world. But we also don't think about the fact that militarization also means here at home. And the primary militarizing force, occupying force in black communities, are local police departments. And in 1997 alone, the Department of Defense gave 1.2 million pieces of military equipment to police departments. This included assault rifles, grenade launchers, and armored personnel carriers. The military has directly trained more than 30,000 police units. The military-police cooperation has been deadly. Between 1995 and 1998, there was a 34% increase in police use of deadly force. In 2002, the U.S. Army lent 5 RC-7 surveillance planes to local police. Right? So there's a way in which even post 9/11, a lot of the homeland security sort of operas that usually we hear organizations organizing around in relation to South Asians and deportations also impact black people. Right? We just had, I just saw in a paper 2 days ago, so the new thing for, you know, folks into the prison stuff is like gang members. Police departments are now going after gang members now. And so they arrested about 565 gang members in different cities nationally based on Homeland Security laws. A couple months ago, there was a whole week, because Homeland Security meant that local police departments were all connected through different computer systems and could communicate, that in a week's time, 10,000 people were arrested who were fugitives for various crimes, petty to, you know, more serious offenses or whatever. They had 10,000 people in 1 week disappeared from different parts of the country, because that's really what happens in our communities. If you've ever been a child and had somebody go to prison, that person disappears from you. Some of the same forces in which we have organized the left around Asian-specific issues also have impact in black communities. But then the question becomes, then, where is the sympathy for that? And where can an equal coalition function on when there's unequal sympathy and certainly unequal social realities for all the groups involved. And I'll close by reading just a brief passage out of Kwame Ture or Stokely Carmichael's Black with Charles Hamilton's Power book, where they provide a framework for coalitions, which I think is still really helpful for us to think about, and think about are coalitions really necessary or valuable at this point for Black folks, and in what positions. Let me just find it quickly. Okay, so these are the three myths of coalition as they describe it. First, in the context of present-day America, the interests of Black people are identical with the interests of certain liberal, labor, and other reform groups, right? Think about that in terms of, like, Black folks' relationships to Asian American communities. And certainly, you know, where Black youth or other Black people, you know, will talk about, you know, Asians as they experience them in terms of owning stuff in communities, I mean, often we sort of poo-poo that kind of, like, you know, that sort of thinking. But the thing I've been saying to people is we have to get out of, like, our little kind of lefty cliques of, like, us and our three Asian friends, of your Asian and our two Black friends or whatever, and really dealing with, like, what are the social people in the communities are having to engage? And if that is the reality of people's experiences with Asian folks is in a position of power, that is something that is valid and has to be really dealt with in terms of, like, how folks are then going to build coalition if this is folks' experience, is on unequal footing. Second myth of coalition is the fallacious assumption that a viable coalition can be effected between the politically and economically insecure and the politically and economically insecure. Think about what I just said to that. The third myth assumes that political coalitions are and can be sustained on a moral, friendly, sentimental basis by appeals to conscience, right? Coalitions, as they later go on to say, have to be formed out of basic self-interest, right? And if this is the situation that we're looking at, right, what are Black people being forced to enter into coalitions, either symbolically or sort of politically, based on self-interest that they don't have, right? Out of a sense of needing allies, like they feel, folks feel like that they have to and feel bullied into that position. I left New York for a year and spent the year in the South doing some work around prison and policing issues, and part of that was to really, for me, get out of the East Coast, West Coast, like, POC scene, because I really wanted to have to engage Black people in a space where you have to deal with Blackness, and no place better to do that than in the Deep South. There's no way around dealing with Blackness. And Black folks in the South are very clear on this, like, POC model stuff. I mean, I have folks tell me all the time, they see the racial hierarchies in it, they see the color hierarchies in it. They see ways in which their issues as Black people still don't get addressed and don't get met in those things, right? And so I think, like, we have to think about those things, you know, in relation to this sort of coalition model, and if in fact it is a valid one. Thank you.
Okay. We're moving right along. We're trying to get you there. I see people ready to talk. Rodney Camachi is our next speaker, and he's a poet and artist. I knew that part. I didn't have to read that part. I got to put my glasses on. Rodney is a poet and artist, currently working as a teaching artist with the Asian Arts Initiative and a community organizer with the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond. All right, Rodney.
First off, thank you, Tammy, again for, like, organizing this event. I think it's an important dialogue to be had. And also thank the TWC and Darren Kiyuki and everyone that helped out with the publication and all that stuff, too. I just wanted to say, like, I am just humbled by the people on this panel. I think things are just, like, there's a lot of great conversation that could be had and an agenda that could be formed through this. And I think I just wanted to say I am in no way, shape, and form, like, really an expert on this. And I really want to get, I'll really be quick because I really want to hear from such a big group of people now, like, as we've grown in the last hour or so. My work started off in Seattle, actually. This is my third year in Philadelphia, and I was working with the People's Coalition for Justice and also doing a lot of organizing against police accountability and police brutality. And the work that we've been trying to do is really build actions through multiracial settings, but I think multiracial settings are just the most challenging organizing things ever, because of the fact that we come from very different places and different cultures, and also very different educational backgrounds. So thinking about how we organize and how we frame issues was really important in how we dealt with the campaign that we were going to launch. So the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond, they really helped me to gain an understanding of how racism was built up from a species classification, and how it's been continuing to create this racial hierarchy and the color caste system that everybody's kind of been talking about and addressing already. I just wanted to talk about how important I do think multiracial organizing is in the work that we do, because I think and it's not just to be some sort of cute Benetton ad or something like that. We really need to learn from each other's experience and learn from how we operate and whatnot. I think there's a lot of difficulties, a lot of challenges. I think it's difficult just to be saying it's people of color without understanding how different people of color really deal with issues and talk about things. And people of color is just a huge, expansive term that's kind of been not deconstructed enough and not seen as how it's problematic. Sometimes when you get coalitions together and they want to be people of color, all of a sudden they won't have any black people on the table. And that's problematic because the way things get framed, how things get talked about. But to me, I want to say there are a lot more benefits of coming together and really having strong relationships and building a coalition. I think historically, Asians and black people pitted up against each other to create the barriers so that we won't be able to understand how we've maintained a white supremacist, capitalist, homophobic patriarchy, and how this has been really the root of how we don't, I'm getting all fumbled in my words, but I'm not used to this. But I think just part is just I really think it takes a large group of people, a lot of people committed to struggling together and to address why we talk about things in the way we talk about them, but also in just how we learn things, how we've been indoctrinated to know these things. And we talk about immigration, how parents have been taught and then teach their children, how things like that continue to happen. I think I really just want to know from everybody else, because I think everybody's covered a lot of things I've wanted to say. I especially want to hear about the nonprofit thing, so I'm just let's get to that. And then get to I think what's important is everyone else talking about how they've seen this challenging their work. So that's about it.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you to everyone who made this discussion possible tonight. What I want to talk about and have us think about is black and Asian... I'm Tiffany, right? I was introduced before. Is black Asian solidarity possible within the nonprofit system? That's what I want us to think about. And we need to get, one of the things to get to the root at why we're having difficulty with the solidarity issue is we need to understand the context from which we're operating. And I think a lot of us here are operating from the space of being within a nonprofit, right? And so recently, some activists have come up with this term to give analysis to the structure that we're working in that's called the nonprofit industrial complex. And throughout this address. I'm going to call it the NPIC because it's a mouthful. But a lot of us are realizing that this system isn't working for us if we want to create radical change, right? So what I'm going to talk about is, first of all, just give a real quick overview of how the NPIC hinders all progressive movement, and then two, get into specifically how the nonprofit industrial complex creates and funds an analysis of racial justice that promotes an anti-black racism that white groups, Asian groups, and other non-black groups adopt in their campaigns and work. So this makes it particularly difficult for us to even talk about coalition building, and I appreciate the analysis and brought. But I'm going to be real quick in talking about how the NPIC is counter-revolutionary. Can people hear me? Because I'm like leaning into the mic, feels crazy. But yeah, that might work. But this analysis I'm going to draw on about how the nonprofit industrial complex is kind of hinders social justice work in general comes from this conference that happened in May of 2004 that Insight put on, and it was called "The Revolution Will Not Be Funded Beyond the Nonprofit Industrial Complex," and it's a really good. Some good information, good analysis that people should get their hands on if they can. They can go to the Insight website and get the CDs, okay? And the book's coming out? Oh, great. Oh, okay. I'm so impressed. But I'm going to go quickly through five key fundamental problems with the NPIC and then focus on two that I'm going to go to later. One, the NPIC is a corporate tax structure that is wedded to and seeks approval from a violent and oppressive state. Ruthie Gilmore did a good job of bringing that up. Two, the state has a right to monitor our activity individually, so this scrutiny can put us in harm's way. For instance, if the state decides that our activity becomes too radical, it can come down on us. Three, the structure is predicated on a corporate structure and hierarchy that rewards bourgeois credentials and upward mobility. Four, the NPIC is obsessed with institution building, so it prefers to build organizations over organizing people. Five, the NPIC forces us to become accountable to our funders rather than our communities, and that's a lot. A lot of organizations struggle with that and do an internal investigation of what that means to their work. One important thing that we're going to talk about is that this corporate system is financially backed by corporations and foundations, which are centers of amassed wealth gained from the exploitation of people of color. Now, when Ruthie Gilmore and some other panelists brought this up, they didn't get specific about who exactly we're talking about, who were these exploited people who created this wealth, and I'm going to get to that later. And finally, the NPIC model makes it easier for young, economically privileged individuals just coming out of college to start nonprofits rather than engage this long-term struggle and long-term movements. So, while I thought the conference was on point in talking about how we're really playing ourselves if we think we're going to use the nonprofit system to create this radical change that we want, it didn't talk about race. It really minimized race, and I have a particular problem with that. So I'm going to draw on some of the analysis of some folks who are doing work right here in Philadelphia to bring this kind of racial analysis in the nonprofit industrial complex together. Again, this glaring omission about who it was exactly that this country oppressed to create this amount of wealth was brought up by an African-American woman in the audience. She really held the panelists accountable and said, you know, this wealth is directly a result of the exploitation of black and native people in this country. And she called the money reparations money, the money that comes from a foundation, the money that the foundation stores. So one thing I want to do is suggest that every Asian group, non-black group, and particularly white folks take advantage of the trainings offered by Power. And Awari is the co-founder of that organization. I didn't even know they were having a training on say, but I would really suggest that people do that because people need to understand, and right now Power has the most thorough and kind of nuanced analysis of this, but what is your relationship to the capital of a foundation if you're taking the check, right? So if you're an Asian group or non-black group and you're accepting a check from a foundation, what does this mean? So, you know, how are you acting in a way that's anti-black or at best acting in a way which puts your organization in conflict with black struggle by taking this reparations money? So that's something that people need to think about and investigate when they're a part of this nonprofit industrial complex and taking foundation money. I'm also going to talk about funding and resource distribution, which there's another anti-black trend to that too. And we need to be really careful about how we look at numbers and see people who get the bulk of money as being the people in power. We need to look underneath those numbers and do a little bit more of a sophisticated analysis and look at funding trends or the rate of spending. And the Center for Third World Organizing's affiliate group, the Applied Research Center, published a report. It was funded by the foundation. It's called Short Change, Foundation Giving and Communities of Color. It came out in 2003. Anyone can pull it up and check the numbers for themselves. But the data that focused on funding is what I want to pay attention to. They tracked funding to communities of color, black communities, Asian communities, Latino and Native American communities from 1994 to 2001. And they used, you know, three criteria to basically track this foundation support. It was total percentage of foundation dollars designated to a specific group, total dollars received, and the average grant size. So according to the study, funding designated to African Americans in 2000 and 2001 fell 54% from 1998. In 2001, the report found that total grant dollars from 1998 to 2001 decreased by approximately 35%, and that the average grant size dropped from $104,500 to $88,758. This was approximately a 15% decrease. Conversely, according to the study, funding designated to Asian American, Asian Pacific communities, 1994 and 2001, ranged from about 0.3% to 0.5% of total grant dollars. It didn't indicate if it was increasing over this period of time or it was decreasing, so I'm not sure about that, but it did report that the average grant grew by 125% in the period between 1994 and 2001. They also did track the funding trends for Latinos, who tallied the highest numbers in all categories, and who also showed increases as funding to Native Americans reflected funding at its lowest level over the past decades. So, you know, I really want to challenge us to look at numbers in a more critical way, because when we're talking about issues of equity, and the system's broken, so, I mean, we're going to be reformists when we're talking about equity within the nonprofit industrial complex, but we need to stop adopting this really shallow analysis that says whoever has the most dollars has the most power, because it's not true, because if we're looking at the trends over time, in this period from 1994 to 2001, a decrease or downward trend in foundation giving to African Americans, as there has been an upward movement for Asian Americans. And, you know, speaking of issues of equity, I'm not trying to problematize that Asians are getting more money. I mean, that's not a problem when you're trying to reach equity. But at the same time, we need to make an issue of the fact that African Americans are receiving less. So these trends of going up and down for people who are shortchanged within the system, that's not moving towards equity at all. So we can't look at that, you know, as an equitable situation as Asians and their fair share, because that's not what's happening. There's a constant decrease in most categories except for Asians, Latinos, and immigrants. And immigrants, as we heard from Mary, and the whole immigrants' rights issue does not include blacks, which is a particular problem. So I'm trying to be really quick. But there's another study that came out that W.K. Kellogg Foundation did. It was called Emerging Philanthropy in Communities of Color. And I would suggest that people go to this website. You don't have to take what I'm offering as what's actually in here. I have some quotes that I pulled that talks about how perceptions of philanthropy and mainstream institutions differ within communities of color, right? So, for one instance, they talk about how communities of color prefer to give their money. So they were saying that, let me just read this, many members of communities of color prefer direct informal support of children, elders of groups that reflect personal ties rather than giving to institutions or organized philanthropies. Giving to scholarship funds appear to be the exception to this rule among Native American, Latin, African American donors, while Asian American donors overall appear to be more comfortable giving to mainstream institutions. So I want to think about that, different groups' relationship to mainstream institutions and how we feel about them. The second quote, the Council on Foundation reports on African American, Latino, and Native American communities identifies a general distrust of mainstream institutions and the culture they represent. And the experience of members of these communities, reports suggest, institutions representing the interests and resources of the majority have not traditionally addressed the needs and issues of people of color. So not only is it kind of distrust about who's managing the fund, but there's this historical relationship to mainstream institutions as being oppressive to these communities ways that Latinos, African Americans, and Native Americans reflect in their responses that Asians don't. So, you know, we need to think about, and what are the implications of this and how we look at mainstream institutions, particularly when it comes to foundation funding. So, you know, this question is, do or will Asian groups or groups less adverse to foundations or mainstream institutions within the nonprofit industrial complex receive more substantial support than groups with a more adversarial relationship to the history of foundations? This is something we really need to consider in our foundation work and when we think about kind of growing our organizations within this nonprofit industrial complex. I was going to talk about the immigrant rights movement as a new kind of social justice issue after 9/11, but I think that Mary hit it right on the nose and like the inherent racism of there being this separate kind of immigrant rights movement that doesn't take into account the lived reality of black people, particularly black immigrants. So I want to talk about how the nonprofit industrial complex really plays in kind of exacerbating the split. And the quote that I want to go to, I think it was Ananya Bhattacharjee kind of brought it up, that this idea that, you know, a recent college graduate can come right out of college and start a nonprofit rather than engage this kind of long-term struggle that's been going on. But I think that's true when people are thinking about programs that are going to add to their organizations. You know, it's the trend is that the nonprofit encourages the emergence of these kind of novel issues, distinguish themselves from existing movements. So often our funders will have us describe how our work is like really original and unreplicated by other social justice groups. In other words, you know, commodify ourselves and make ourselves really exotic so we can get that funding dollar, right? So the foundation community doesn't hold the immigrants' rights movement, which is primarily Asian and brown, their movement against state violence, accountable for developing, you know, this cross-cutting analysis that links itself to an existing black movement against state violence, which was occurring, you know, 1997, Abner Louima, 1999, Amadou Diallo's issue in Cambria Heights, where all these people are rounded up because a white police officer is shot. These folks were immigrants too. So it doesn't make, you know, the immigrants' rights issue, which is Asian, connect itself to that. So, I mean, I think a thing we need to be thinking about, and I like what Kenyon brought up about, do we really need coalition building in our work to really think about that critically, is if we want to even talk about the possibility of solidarity, we need to think about it outside of this structure of the nonprofit industrial complex. So that's it.
Okay, it's almost time. Last panelist is Yuari Osayande. He's a poet, political activist, and author of several books, including Black Anti-Ballistic Missives, Resisting War, Resisting Racism, and the forthcoming Misogyny and the MC, Exposing the Exploitation of Black Women in Hip Hop. His next book of poems entitled Blood Luxury will be published this year by Africa World Press. The Quarterly Black Review called Osayande one of America's newest insurgent intellectuals coming to the table with enough mental firepower to be a David Walker of our time. He currently resides in Philadelphia, PA, where he's co-founder of Power, People Organized, working to eradicate racism. He is also creator of a series of workshops called Onus, Redefining Black Manhood. Lewis Gordon, professor of philosophy at Temple University, has called Osayande passionate, provocative, evocative, insightful, and always truthful. Osayande's work stands as one of the best examples of prophetic criticism that speaks not only to and from the contemporary African experience, but to anyone interested in the struggle for human liberation.
Good evening. So here we are, 50 years after Bandung, we come to speak about the progress of relations between blacks and Asians. When upon close examination, we will realize that relations have always been strained. Unity has been longed for by some, realized in any tangible way. We hold on to the images of individual Asians involved in black liberation struggle, or African American involvement with revolutionary Maoism, hoping to extract some kernel of connection that can bring the masses of our people together. But even in the most progressive of circles, the tensions that exist are often just brewing below the surface. So the question becomes, why have our communities remained at arm's length? Further, who among us have benefited and why? In the effort to have a true, honest conversation about the relationship between African Americans and Asian Americans, we must place that conversation within the context of white supremacy or racism. I'm talking real fast and I'm trying to keep within my time frame. So if you don't catch me, you know, I'll bring it up in the conversation. In the effort to have a true, honest conversation about the relationship between African American and Asian, we gotta place this conversation within the context of white supremacy. For it is only in that space we can begin to understand what has happened to our peoples, what has become of this desired unity. The fact is that the institution of white supremacy has worked diligently to keep Asians and blacks apart despite the possible common themes that might bind us. In that vacuum has emerged a dominant society's vision of black-Asian coalition that has made a mockery of our determination, offering us a bad amalgamation of what's been called chopstick or blaxploitation flicks in the likes of Chris Tucker and Jackie Chan movies, where we mock each other and laugh at ourselves as Hollywood goes laughing all the way to the bank, successfully reinforcing racist stereotype for another generation. Just like in the movies, we still don't understand each other. Because, you know, like, you go see the film and Chris is bugging on Jackie because he can't understand him. And Jackie looking at him funny, like trying to say the words because he can't understand him. That's how it is with us, too. Not about language, but about understanding our relationship to each other and why it is we can't connect. Because we fail to understand. That failure to understand each other is due to our failure to understand how racism has in our vision and our ability to effectively communicate a common vision of justice for all oppressed people. The 20th century began as called by Du Bois as the century of the color line, started prior to that for some in the Asian community as well as the African American community. The Haynes-Tilden Compromise of 1877 that put a halt to the black reconstruction in the South will be followed in 1882 by the Chinese Exclusion Act, which disrupted Chinese immigration. The common denominator of both these acts was found in the white workers who in their racism did not want to compete with black or Asian labor. This kind of blatant racism would remain law with little to no change or adjustment until 1965. It was in that year that blacks, after decades-long battle, would win voting rights protection within the passing of the Voting Rights Act that still ain't protected. Just months after the signing of the Civil Rights Act, that same year Congress also passed the 1965 Immigration Act. The following year, see, we talk about this model minority piece, but many folk don't know when it emerges. And this is necessary to understand given the fact that clearly, it's played a role in how race gets conversated in this country. It was the following year, in fact, in 1966, that the model minority myth emerges in the American vernacular. According to a U.S. News and World Report published that year, it's quote, at a time, I'm quoting now the article, at a time when Americans are awash in worry over the plight of racial minorities, now who could they be talking about? 96. One such minority, the nation's 300,000 Chinese Americans, is winning wealth and respect by dint of its own hard work. In any Chinatown from San Francisco to New York, you discover youngsters at grips with their studies. Still being taught in Chinatown is the old idea that people should depend on their own efforts, not a welfare check, in order to reach America's promised land. Now, whose language is that? Promised land, but black folks. Visit China USA and you find an important racial minority pulling itself up from hardship and discrimination, become a model of self-respect and achievement in today's America. And so the model minority myth, unquote, unquote, this is me now. And so the model minority myth was born at a time when African Americans were still battling for basic rights. Clearly, as evidenced by the language used, this myth was created not just to bring division among people of color, but to specifically undermine black and Latino determination and quest for social justice here. Some Asian Americans quickly resisted the moniker. Organizations like the Red Guard, inspired by the radical example of the Black Panther Party, who in turn were inspired by Malcolm X and Mao Zedong, yet still many others would profess disdain for the myth even as they secretly relished being approved by whites. Today, certain Asian Americans, in their effort to buck the model minority myth, rush to take on a form of blackness. Yeah, we gotta talk about it. Come on now. That eyes challenges certain race Asian stereotypes. Now, we can talk about this in terms of gender, how, you know, in the racist white imagination, black men are over-sexualized. Asian men are under-sexualized, or even in some cases, asexualized. The interesting thing about it is that the women in our respective communities are constantly over-sexualized. That doesn't change when it comes to sisters, when it comes to the women question. White society has always viewed women of color, regardless, as sexually other. That's what that's about. But in terms of the gender, in terms of how us men, and so you have certain Asian men now saying, well, we don't want to be seen as asexual, so they want to rush and take on this notion of blackness in the hopes of gaining the sexuality that is fraud and fraudulent. Yet what they fail to consider is the fact that they are jumping out of the proverbial pan into the fire. For what they are embracing is not a cultural identity at all, but a commodity. Another set of stereotypes from the white racist imagination and imposed on black people by the media. The image of blackness has become a commercial fetish that gets read as code for what it means to be hip, cool, or urban in the capitalist marketplace. Our scars have been turned over into stars that leave others bedazzled, but the image ain't us, no matter how many self-proclaimed niggas play the part. So now you got so-called yellow people trying to be black, but then denying that desire in the process. Their denial of their desire is rooted in an anti-black sentiment learned, just like all of us, living here in the US of A. For in order for them to maintain their Americanness, they must hold on to their anti-black attitude, and so they harbor disdain for black people even as they don this projection of what they think blackness is. In the process, proclaiming that it's not about being black, but we're just trying to be cool, just trying to be hip, urban, and other cultural euphemisms that serve as camouflage to hide or cover up the truth. Oliver Wang and Jeff Cheng are two academics who rep the intellectual wing trend. As writers or hip-hop journalists, they market in cultural confusion. Prize non-whites who rep the new school in the colored sections of the ivory tower, who are thankful to the boss man for their time in the literary spotlight complete with health benefits. They relish in the novelty of doing Asians doing hip-hop. Their work only works to stir the racist brew rather than eliminate it, and that's their fundamental problem. They who defend their cultural identity even as they appropriate others, but damn blacks who do the very same thing. That kind of contradiction smacks of a cultural chauvinism and elitism that exposes their class aspirations. They are cultural charlatans, intellectual opportunists who seek status and privilege at the expense of actual solidarity with the oppressed they profess to rep. So why should they expect us to rally around an image that does not honor us as black people? That's critical. Whether you call it black or hip-hop or hip or urban, it ain't real. And it's certainly more an act of resistance to the forces that have terrorized, brutalized, and oppressed the black community for centuries now. Whenever it's been reported in the white-owned and controlled media that African-Americans have made insensitive and demeaning remarks about Asians, it is met with an anti-black backlash on the part of certain Asians. What makes this troubling is not that they, Asians, are defending their community against prejudice and cultural disrespect. That's correct. But what is problematic is the fact that they only focus on the black face and miss the white monster that is the manufacturer of the mayhem and racism. It's problematic. Now I'm referring now to the Hot 97 thing with the tsunami song. Now, black folk be complaining about folk in the media since we've been here. Ain't nobody ever get fired over that. Yet on this situation, two black folk got fired, right? They had an article in the New York Daily News interviewing one of the cast that got fired. Now, I'm not defending him whatsoever. I want to make a point here. He made it clear that he got direction from Emmis Communications, the company that owns Hot 97, that are a bunch of white folks, because they were concerned about the competition that they were getting from Star and Buck Wild. And so they said, we want something offensive. Make something about this tsunami thing. And that's what they did, because to keep their jobs. But I didn't hear a lot of folk talking about taking out MS Communications. And finally, the conflict is over. Now that they have fired them, MS can continue to do their racism and we just continue to listen up. What makes this troubling is not that they defend their community against prejudice and cultural disrespect, but the fact that by only focusing on the black face, they miss that white monster. There is meaning here. It means that their cry for justice is disingenuous, for it fails to be directed at the structures of dominance that dictate public policy. This results in cultural casualties that results from living under a system of white supremacy where we end up contending with each other rather than fighting the forces that sit at the source of our confusion. Very quickly on this black-white binary, and I'm gonna bring it to a close. Brother Kenyon already spoke to this, but I just wanna, you know, throw my two cents in there with it. This black-white binary, first thing, black folks did not create this structure. We ain't have no hand in it. We suffering from it. So we don't like it no more than you do. So if you got an issue with the black-white binary, take it up with the folks that made it. Don't take it up with us. Don't come yelling at us about, you know, we need to be more inclusive in our logic, in our analysis. Take it up with the people who created it. Like what we've been doing since we've been here. Finally, I'm going to quote Malcolm. Malcolm in his latch said that, this is him talking now. Along about 1955, they had the Bandung Conference in Indonesia. And at that time, the Africans, the Asians, the Arabs, and all the non-white peoples got together and agreed to de-emphasize their difference and emphasize what they had in common and form a working unity. The spirit of Bandung created a working unit and made it possible for the Asians who were oppressed, the Africans who were oppressed, and others who were oppressed to work together toward getting independence for these and other people. And most of this began in 1959 when that spirit of African nationalism was fanned to a high flame, and we then began to witness the complete collapse of colonialism. France began to get out of French West Africa. Belgium began to make moves to get out of the Congo. Britain began to make moves to get out of Kenya, Tanganyika, Uganda, Nigeria, and some of these other places. And although it looked like they were getting out, they pulled a trick that was colossal. In that when you're playing basketball and they get you trapped, you don't throw the ball away. You throw it to one of your teammates who was in the clear. This is what the Europe did. They were trapped on the African continent. They couldn't stay there. They were looked upon as colonial imperialists. So they had to pass the ball to someone whose image was different. And they passed the ball to Uncle Sam. And he picked it up and has been running with it ever since. End quote. As the US population demographics continue to change, this is me talking now, and projections are being made that American society will go from being a white majority to a majority population of people of color, many are already projecting that whiteness and institutional white supremacy will die a rather natural death. What they fail to understand is that whiteness is not about biology. Whiteness is a political construct. And just as whites in South Africa accommodated certain people of color and made them honorary white folks, namely Asians, the question has to become, now that America finds itself trapped, who will the US whites pass the ball to? Who will become the new white folks? And in so becoming, work to maintain the oppression of black people and other people of color who do not fit the model. Thank you.
Okay. I know a lot of people got questions. A lot of people have comments. I'm going to ask you to be respectful. There's a lot of people in here that probably want to have something to say. So that means that we can't afford for anyone to stand up and take 10 minutes. All right? Everybody's cool with that? We're all right. We'll move forward. We got about 30.